Okay, I'm with Erwin Marcus on the 1st of July in the year 2009, and he's going to tell us about the background of GN or the.
Henry.
What are you going to talk about today?
Whatever you want.
Oh, okay, well, I think you're going to GM.
Henry.
You're going to do the GM lecture?
I can do.
Okay.
Element of that, yeah.
Okay, all right, well, whatever you think would be interesting to people in July of 2009, historically.
The story begins in 1908, when General Motors was formed. Initially, it was a combination of companies drawing on Chevrolet, Buick, and Oldsmobile. The major breakthrough was under William C. Durant, who was a very ambitious, risk-taking, at most times successful entrepreneur, who was the head of General Motors for most of the period until 1921, when he ran into troubles with his speculative investments and was replaced by Alfred Sloan and Pierre DuPont. The highlight of Durant's career at General Motors was his recognition of Louis Chevrolet and the combination of Chevrolet with technology developed by General Motors, which in the 1920s turned General Motors into the number one car manufacturing company in the United States and in the world, displacing Henry Ford and the Model T. What is going to occur is that General Motors needs money. The DuPonts made a lot of money during World War I. They were looking for a place for investment. Although they did not know much about the automobile industry, they thought it had a future, and Alfred Sloan became the key figure in General Motors. His role would continue for several decades, and during that period, General Motors would reach number one position and retain that position, with a few exceptions, until the present, when it was displaced by Toyota. Why was General Motors able to achieve number one position? I think it's a combination of factors. One factor is that Henry Ford was so successful with the Model T. It's hard to conceive of success being the root of decline. But Henry Ford was so successful with the $5 day, the movable assembly line, division of labor, mass production, mass consumption, that once the world changed, the United States changed in the 1920s, he wasn't able to change with the changing times. Part of it was those around him, his associates. Initially, during the Model T era, he had individuals who were strong, individuals who had independent minds, individuals who would say no to Henry Ford. By the 1920s, this group had virtually disappeared and was replaced by another group of mainly yes men who would say, yes, Mr. Ford, you're right, Mr. Ford. And he had no one to stand up to him and criticize him and call for a change. The Model T, which fit the needs of the 1910s, farmers, doctors, skilled workers, did not fit the desires and needs of the 1920s. For at least some Americans, the 1920s was a period of prosperity, period of the radio, movies, cars, alcohol, Freud's dreams, Lindbergh, Babe Ruth. It was a time when people try to be gay, look for excitement, look for adventure, and the Model T did not fit into that as a standardized black car. General Motors, on the other hand, realized the changing needs and desires of the consumer and responded to them effectively. One of the first developments was, instead of having to crank your car as you did with the Model T, there was the automatic starter. That was not only a technological advance, a convenience to consumers, but it created a new labor market, a new consumer market composed of women. women didn't want to crank their cars, but with the automatic starter and some of the features that General Motors brought about, now you had a dual consumer market composed of men and women. In addition to that, General Motors brought out cars that had different colors. They brought out cars that could be purchased with a down payment and General Motors Acceptance Corporation monthly payments, unlike Ford, who had a lower priced car, but one which had to be purchased at one time rather than with down payment and payments as you went along. In addition to that, General Motors came up with a concept that was forwarded by advertising that emphasized status. The Model T emphasized tangible factors. It was easy to repair, got good mileage, could travel on various roads, including unpaved ones, was reliable. General Motors didn't so much emphasize the car's qualities inherent in the vehicle, but try to give you an impression of a dream, try to give you an impression of status, try to give you an impression of desirability in mobility. So you can start out with a Chevrolet, then move up to a Pontiac, an Oldsmobile, a Buick, and even a Cadillac. So as your income increased, as you became more status conscious, as you try to become a more important member of your community, you could reflect that in the cars you purchased. In addition to which, there was the annual model change. So even if you couldn't afford a Pontiac and only a Chevrolet, you'd have a 1926 Chevrolet in 1926. Moving on to the 1930s, the Depression changed the automobile industry dramatically. Prior to this time, there were a variety of vehicles. The Durant was one of them. These companies, the Durant, the Maxwell, and some others, could not survive the effects of the Depression. So although you did not have the big three you would have later on, you had a reduction in the number of car companies operating in the United States. Another change that took place in the 1930s is the unionization of the automobile workers. This has been tried before with limited success. The Industrial Workers of the World, 1913, attempted to unionize, had limited success in doing that. And during the 1920s, the automobile industry was essentially a non-union operation. In the 1930s, however, that changed. The working conditions declined, wages declined, unemployment became a problem, and the workers looked for collective action to deal with their situation. The result of that was the formation of the CIO under John Lewis and United Automobile Workers to meet the needs of the workers. Although the General Motors workers in 1936-37 had among their grievances a major grievance about the speed of the assembly line, that was not one that would be handled by striking. Nevertheless, the strikes of 1937 against Chrysler and against General Motors had success. I won't go into details about the sit-down strike, which is the most important strike of the year, or maybe the most important strike, or one of the most important strikes in the history of the United States. But essentially, a new technique was used because General Motors could not be defeated by traditional tactics. The idea was to sit down so you couldn't be replaced by workers who would take over your job. It would reduce the profits of the automobile company. It would publicize the issue, the right to a job as well as the right of private property. With the intervention of John Lewis and Frank Murphy, gains were made by the United Automobile Workers and the automobile workers. And what happened was they gained the seniority system, they gained the wage increases, they gained the union recognition. The union grew, became one of the most important unions in the United States labor movement. During World War II, the leaders of the United Automobile Workers signed the No-Strike Pledge, but particularly in 1943, local labor leaders in the United Automobile Workers and automobile workers went on strike. Walter Reuther is emerging as a key figure, particularly in the General Motors Company, as a key labor leader. At the end of the war, there's a strike wave in 1946. The automobile workers are an element of that. General Motors goes on strike. The company is hit by a strike. Walter Reuther negotiates and proposes that instead of a normal settlement, he wanted to get the public on his side and the side of the union, the side of the workers. So he tells General Motors if they'll open the books and they really can't afford to meet the demands of the union would reduce its demands. General Motors refused to do that. He also said that if General Motors would reduce the price of cars, the Automobile Workers Union would take that into consideration in making its demands. What's going to grow out of this is a recognition by the union that they can't make gains at the expense of management rights. Management will not give up the right to keep its books secret, would not give up the right to have the union affect what cars they produced, the sale price of the cars, where the cars were produced. So what the union will concentrate on over the next several decades is an approach that will gain fringe benefits for the workers, wage increases, productivity gains for the workers in financial terms, holidays, vacations, pensions, medical care. What's going to happen is that General Motors will concentrate in the next several decades on producing big cars, because big cars are cars that will, on a unit basis, generate more income for the company than production of small cars. Walter Reuther, at an early stage, said that the company should consider producing small cars, but they weren't take that into account. They wouldn't make the decisions. As we look at General Motors, we're looking at the city in which they operate, Detroit. In the 1920s, Detroit was a booming city. People moved to Detroit from many parts of the United States. During World War II, Detroit was also a booming city. Whites from the South, blacks from the South moved to Detroit. Detroit economy grew. Racial tensions also grew. There was a race riot in 1943. Difficulties with housing, recreation, transportation. But Detroit was considered a city on the move upward. By the 1960s, Detroit was having problems. Racial problems, in particular, which culminated in the 1967 race riot, in which about 35 people were killed, died, and many more were injured, a lot of property destroyed. In response to that, General Motors and the other major employers in Detroit came up with the idea of a Renaissance Detroit, an approach where Detroit would be rejuvenated. And part of Detroit was rejuvenated. Highways were built, new buildings went up, new hotel went up, but the city at its core declined and has continued to decline since that time. What was happening was that there was not only a split within the population of Detroit on the basis of race, black and white, but it also affected the union. Within the union, a black caucus emerged, within the United Automobile Workers, and several special groups emerged, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which included DRUM, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement. So there was racial conflict within the union and racial conflict between black workers who were associated with specifically black radical organizations. A period ended in 1970 when Walter Reuther died in an airplane crash. After that, what we see is a new circumstance. New circumstance grows out of the Vietnam War and the cost, the economic cost to the country, which were not borne by other countries such as Japan and Germany, for reindustrializing, developing their steel industries, developing their automobile industries, and becoming competitors with the United States in both areas. in addition to the Vietnam War and its effects, you know, the energy crisis, the increase in gasoline prices. The 1970s was a period of stagflation for the general economy. In other words, you had inflation plus a stagnant economy, and that also affected General Motors. General Motors made some attempts to respond to the influx of foreign cars, particularly Japanese cars. Initially, they could do so by saying these cars were not of high quality. They made jokes about the vehicles. The Toyota was a toy, not comparable to a Chevrolet or a Plymouth or a Ford. But the quality of Japanese cars would improve, and the big three would have to respond. General Motors responded initially by geographic diversification. It moved out of Detroit to some extent, established a new plant in Lordstown, Ohio, produced a Vega, a new car, a small car to compete with the Japanese. But it turned out that this experiment was more positive in theory than it was in practice. The work ethic, which they expected to be much better in Lordstown, did not turn out to be that way for the workers. They complained about the boredom of the job, the lack of initiative on the part of workers, the lack of control on the part of workers. You had something called the blue-collar blues emerging. The Vega experiment did not work too well. Although periodically, General Motors has tried to move into a small car field, they're more comfortable with larger cars or special cars. For example, there was an article in the paper the other day about the demand by the public for the Corvair, for the Camaro, called a muscle car, and General Motors wanting to respond to this demand by producing more of them, not taking into account global warming, pollution, energy use. This shows that General Motors at times, too often, is affected by a short-term perspective rather than a long-term perspective. The present condition of General Motors is due to a variety of factors: international competition, unresponsiveness to consumer needs and demands, mismanagement, top-heavy management, excessive meetings, long meetings, a corporation that, instead of looking at itself in the mirror and saying we have done some things that we shouldn't have done, the Hummer is a current example. It has turned to the government, most recently for the bailout. Prior to that time, for grants and aid, tariffs, restrictions on imports, it has called upon the union and the workers to make concessions to the company. And it got itself into a very difficult position. Lately, it has been replaced by Toyota as the number one car producer of the world. It's also gotten itself in a position where it was vulnerable to the financial and economic downturn, which is plaguing the United States and the world today.